there. Thank you for stopping by. I'm Henrik. I hope you're starting to enjoy the initial steps towards spring. If you are in the Northern Hemisphere, we are approaching the wonderful time of Easter. Bunnies, eggs, fertility, wonderful traditional celebrations that is all about new, beautiful life. Additions to our folk and more life to our beautiful world. It definitely is a time of new life, new beginnings, and rebirth. And I hope you are in tune with the nature around you and the seasons and are aware of why our ancestors associated the things they did with this particular time of year. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio, an independent radio program. You can find much more of what we do at redeyescreations.com. If you think that we touch upon some heavy topics, well, then you're right. It can be heavy. And it should. You can get a lot of lighthearted entertainment in a lot of places these days that don't really get you anywhere, keep you in those shallow areas. But don't get me wrong, we do need a good laugh. More often it feels like these days, considering how absurd everything is getting. But we do try to stay on point and figure out, by bringing on various guests that elaborates on some of the challenges of our times, why things are the way they are, how they got that way, and also, of course, what we can do about it. We look at history, pop culture, conspiracies, metapolitical and metaphysical issues that lie underneath the surface stuff where most people dwell. Well, today we have with us historian and former professor E. Michael Jones. He's been with us once before, and I do enjoy listening to what he has to say. I don't agree with everything he says, which is, as you know, not the point, but we do try to bring you perspectives and topics that you won't get as much elsewhere. And these are some of the censored scholars and many of the authors that don't get the attention that they should in the press, as they are branded as thought criminals. Because, as you know, our government and the people controlling the debate only do have our best interests at heart, really. And they really care for us. You know, they want to protect us from these evil ideas, right? So they just know that you can't handle hearing a different story, much less the truth. So let's not give it any focus, shall we? But anyway, I appreciate Dr. Jones, his candor, his fearless and outspoken attitudes. He doesn't care about being politically correct or stepping on any toes. And I think we need more people like him that speak their heart and mind and are vocal about what they have found in their work. He is the author of Libido Dominandi, and that is the main topic that we're going to talk about today. Pornography, the transformation of our moral code, which has led, I think, to a lot of problems in our society, and at least not relationships between men and women. Ironically, we've been told that these are the issues that have set us free, but in reality they have actually enslaved us. We are going to look a bit closer today at 50 Shades of Grey, the progression of so-called sexual liberation, and the aid of the media in this, the storytelling techniques of Hollywood, how they have changed, and how they have changed our values. A little bit later, we're going to speak more about his experiences in India. He recently visited there, and he's made some interesting observations. What we can see happening in India today is something that happened in America and other parts of the West in the 50s and 60s, he argues. And by observing India, we can get a glimpse of how our own culture was transformed by so-called sexual liberation. But keep in mind, as Aldous Huxley said, as political and economic freedom diminishes, sexual freedom tends compensatingly to increase. And isn't that true for the times we are in? Pornography and smut peddling is all part of the bread and circuses to keep you occupied and entertained. Well, today's show is not for the faint of heart. As always, E. Michael Jones speak candidly. But stay with us if you're ready to hear more. Dr. Jones, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming back on the program again. It's great to have you here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to bring you on because you've done so much good work on looking at how our media has changed over the years, and also, of course, how pornography has become a more and more prominent leading kind of pillar, if you will, both in education, but also certainly, most certainly, in entertainment. And, of course, we recently had the book 50 Shades of Grey that was turned into a movie and has been tremendously successful for some interesting reason. It seems to have been a massive hit among many kind of older, moms and things like that. I think, Devin, the term they used for it was actually mommy porn, if you can believe that. But it's everything from sadism to bondage and all kinds of nastiness in it. But you've written about this in Libido Dominandi, of course, a little bit, Michael. But What do you think about when you see movies like this coming out and when you see that there's a slow kind of transformation of our entertainment media in this way, Michael?
Yeah, I thought that 50 Shades of Grey was more about capitalism than it was about pornography. Or let's put it this way, the intersection between capitalism and pornography, it seems to me, is what we're talking about here. And I think that this is an important issue. Because I think, especially in cultures like India now, which are being opened up to capitalist exploitation, I think that what you see there is the role that pornography plays in creating basically a docile labor force, a docile workforce that will allow itself to be exploited. And I think that what you see in 50 Shades of Grey is the metaphor for this is basically the contract. I have to admit, I haven't seen the movie. I haven't had the pleasure of watching the lady being tortured. But I read some summaries of it, and it turns out that basically the whole thing revolves around her signing a contract. Now, this is the way this culture absolves itself from all moral responsibility. And so I think that's what this movie is about. There's this lady who, for some reason, has these irrational desires. She wants to escape from responsibility for acting on these irrational desires, so she has this fantasy about signing a contract. Now, this goes way back, I think, in European culture. I think it goes back to Faust. If you remember, the Faust story is about a contract. The Faust story came into existence in Germany at around the time of the emergence of the money economy from the Middle Ages. So before that time, you owed the Lord 3 days of work. You worked 3 days for your own, and you took a day off. Now you need money to pay your taxes, and the question is, where am I going to get money? And there was this kind of magic, aura of magic surrounding Faust. And I think what we're talking about here is the usurious contract, or usury, which is basically you borrow money. And then you've got this money, and money allows you to do whatever you want, and everything's great. And then suddenly, wait a minute, I got to pay it back. And that was the beginning of Faust. And so what you're seeing here is the same type of thing. Capitalism is basically state-sponsored usury. And so what you have is now a whole country like India now being seduced in the literal sense of the word, being flooded with sexual imagery, pornography, and resulting in a rape crisis. But that is not the end of the story, because the purpose of pornography is to basically open the culture up to capitalist exploitation. And so what all of these things, as I said, I haven't seen the movie. If I could read the book, if I could think about it in light of actual things, I might be able to come up with something more coherent and cogent at this point. But it seems to me that that's what we're talking about here. The relationship between capitalism and pornography is an intimate, if you excuse the pun there, an intimate relationship, and you can see it best in a country like India right now.
Yeah, I definitely want to ask you more about that later. It's an interesting thing though, because it's something we can see now in real time. In the West, of course, this subversion occurred a long time ago, so now we have to go into the records, we have to try to figure it out, but we can look at other parts of the world to kind of see it in action and also see, of course, the consequences of that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more before we go into that direction of the nature of pornography and the way that it's how it works and how it manages to do what it does to us. I mean, I think as a consequence, we've seen a breakdown of the family to it. It's created a lot of tremendous problems. I think it was even actually a TED talk that discussed quite interesting. It was a while ago since I saw it now, so I don't have all the details, but they actually talked about how men become impotent if they are engaged or looking at too much pornography, etc.
Right.
So it has a lot of consequences, which is kind of not really being discussed in the West today, you know?
No, well, first of all, pornography is portrayed as a form of freedom or an expression of freedom. That's the fundamental misrepresentation that takes place across the board. It's still happening. It was the opening wedge that allowed pornography into the West. And it's totally false. And the people who were promoting it, I think, knew that it was totally false. The best example I can give of the real purpose of pornography, or the, what should I say, the military purpose of pornography, was the example I've given in talks all over the world of the Israelis in 2003 invading Gaza, take over the TV stations and start broadcasting pornography over Palestinian TV stations. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Israelis are bringing freedom to the Palestinians? They want to liberate the Palestinians? Well, that's a stretch. I don't think anybody believes that, certainly not in light of all the subsequent incursions into Gaza that the Israelis have done. No, it's a form of control. And then it came down, after I did the research on it, it turns out that both Shin Bet and the CIA came up with the solution. Well, flood the Palestinian population with pornography. It's a young population. Most of the people are under the age of 30. They will become preoccupied. They will become isolated, and that will be the end of their political involvement. Well, that, I think, exposes the real meaning of pornography, because pornography, by its very definition, is a political act. It is created for mass consumption. It's a product that is sold, and the government, the regime, or whatever you want to call it, either allows it or forbids it, but there's some type of interface with the political system whenever pornography is in existence. And I think the beginning, as I described in my book, Libido Dominandi, the beginning of this was France at the time of the French Revolution. And if you read the Marquis de Sade, who was a pornographer who started the French Revolution, if you read Justine, if you read his philosophy of the bedroom, you know that he felt that it was a way of mobilizing the population to make them more revolutionary, to keep them in motion. I think subsequent theorists have felt that it's a way of anesthetizing the population. But either way, it's a way of having an effect on the population with some type of political purpose.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a bit more about, I mean, prostitution, for example, these things have existed for a very long time in many different cultures and whatnot, but that's not really what we're talking about here. It's more the application of pornography to the masses when it, you know, becomes
right,
widely available in that capacity. And I believe that it was the Nickelodeon theaters in the early days at the root of the movie industry. We know, of course, that this is the porn industry is Hollywood's shadow side, it's been called, but in the beginning, it was really spearheaded into effect with the aid of movie technology, correct?
Pornography is always a function of technology, always. And so at the time of the Marquis de Sade, it was the book and also the engraving. They did engravings of people engaged in pornographic activity. The next big step forward was photography, and the next big step forward after that was moving motion pictures. Movie, cinema. And that was a Jewish operation. The Jews took over Hollywood. They were involved in pornography from the beginning. And they started to use this new medium as a way of subverting the morals of United States culture. And so during the 1920s, there was a huge hue and cry against Hollywood, largely by the Protestants. It was a primarily Protestant country at this point. The Protestants failed to reign in Hollywood, and then the Catholics stepped up to the plate. And Cardinal Doherty of Philadelphia called for a boycott of Warner Brothers theaters in Philadelphia. Harry Warner was losing $100,000 a week. That's Depression-era dollars. That's a lot of money. At a time when Hollywood was deeply in debt because they had invested in talking pictures. And so the Catholic Church, through the Legion of Decency, basically reigned in Hollywood for 31 years. And then they broke, Hollywood broke the code in 1965 with the film The Pawnbroker, which was a Holocaust film. They used the Holocaust to smuggle bare breasts into the movies, you know, and the Catholics were dumbfounded. They didn't know what to do. And so the Hollywood broke the code. And at that point, the Jews in Hollywood had free reign to take over the media. And that's precisely what they did. And so it led to pornography deep throat within 7 years, being shown in first-run movies. But more importantly, it led to total Jewish control of the media. The Catholic Church had neutered itself. It had lost the media battle. And the result was, I would say, the wars in the Middle East. You know, and the projection of this idea, now that the Americans have been conquered, now the people who ruled America, the ruling class elites, which was the WASP, Rockefeller, combine, sort of up until the 1970s, and then the Jews after that, they could project this onto the world as the sort of the first wave of assault on your culture. And that's precisely what happened in India beginning in the 1990s. When the Soviet Union failed, India, which had always been a traditional ally of the Soviet Union, turned to the West. They got IMF loans. Once they got the IMF loans, the condition was you have to open up the media. Once you open up the media, the people who are investing determine what you're going to see. And then suddenly you have the sexualization of the culture. And people don't know what's happening, but they're upset. And the result of this spinning out of control is the rape crisis that is now plaguing India. So these are the interconnections that I see. To get back to your original point, pornography is not prostitution. Prostitution is, in a sense, a private act.
Right.
But pornography is always a public act. It's always a publication. It's always a movie. And then the final barrier, the final technological barrier was the Internet. And there was a big battle in the early 90s in the United States over whether there was going to be pornography on the Internet. And Hollywood won through propaganda films like The People versus Larry Flint and Boogie Nights, which were basically two propaganda films, pro-pornography propaganda films, that convinced the legislators that they should pass the so-called Communications Decency Act, which then was the Communications Indecency Act, which allowed the free exchange of pornography over the Internet. So now you had look, this has always been a technological problem. So if we go back to the Marquis de Sade, his proposal was exhibit the women naked in the theaters. Okay, great. But we got a technological problem there, because either you have a big theater, in which case you're sitting in the back row and you can hardly see the women, or you've got a little theater, in which case you can see the women, but you're only radicalizing or sexualizing 20, 50 people. This was solved by mass media, by the motion picture, and then by the Internet. So now, not only do you have motion pictures, which were put on, sort of tamed by the Catholics in America for a while, now you've got it in everybody's house. Now they have access to pornography, to everyone who has a computer. And so now you see, I think, the full ramifications of using this as a form of control.
Now, just as a quick side issue here, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you know much about Edison. I think it was Rankin was involved in this too. The battle actually over the moving photography, I just found that interesting too, that the Hollywood, you know, Jewish moguls, they didn't want to pay license fees allegedly. And
right.
This is one of the reasons they actually fled to Hollywood land, as it was called at the time, right?
Yeah, and I don't know a whole lot about that story, but I know what you're talking about. And as a matter of fact, I think the lawsuits are still continued to this day. But
really?
Yes, you're right.
Really?
I think so.
That's amazing. Anyway, so let's go back to the other issue here. And how have they managed to convince us then that this is about liberation, right? It's sexual liberation. It's an over focus on sex all the time. It's of course also come in through the through psychology and things like that, and over analyzation on the issue of sexuality all the time. But that somehow WASP society, right, as the classic kind of opposition to a lot of this, that they are sexually deprived and suppressed, and they need to be liberated, right?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a basis in human nature for what they're doing, because there are certain times when you have real strong desires, you know? I mean, you really want to do something. I don't know, it could be you really want to have a drink. You have these appetites, you know? We all have appetites. And the whole, in many ways, the point of life is making sure that your appetite is tamed by reason. Reason's the rider, appetite's the horse. If the rider loses control of the horse, he gets trampled to death. This is the wisdom of the Greeks. It's in Hippolytus, by Euripides' play and also in the Bacchae. What happens when these desires get out of control? You know, death results from this. So you can be in a situation where you really want to do this. Sexual desires are just as strong, maybe even stronger. And so if you sexualize the culture, in other words, if you stimulate these desires, you can come across as both the arsonist and the fireman. You know, you can stimulate the desires through the mass media. These people have these desires that are not conformant to reason, to practical reason, which we call morality. And then the government comes along and says, well, we're going to give you permission to satisfy them. And you can see in this the mobilization of sexual desire, because what you're telling these people is, if you act on this desire, you will be free. You'll feel free. Well, we have enough, anyone who's familiar with the literature and tradition of the West, beginning with Euripides and people like plays like the Bacchae, know that it's the exact opposite. That when you're the thrall, when you're the slave of your desires, you're not free. That these desires can become tyrants. And this was codified by St. Augustine at the time of the fall of the Roman Empire when he wrote The City of God. He said, a man has as many masters as he has vices. This is a revolutionary thought in the history of the West, because people like Plato and Aristotle, great as they were, did not really have a clear understanding of freedom. They would talk about, you know, a prince is rowing across the Mediterranean, gets captured, now he's a galley slave. Well, is he by nature a slave, or is he by nature a prince? Well, Augustine sort of cut to the chase here, cut away all the stuff. He says, a man has as many masters as he has vices. So the whole issue of freedom is purely a question of moral behavior, because moral behavior is practical reason, and we are reasonable creatures. And the only way we can retain our status as reasonable creatures is by acting reasonably, which means by acting morally, which means by subordinating our desires to the moral law, to the truth of rational human nature. So what they did was basically the social engineers turned everything upside down, because by the time of, I'd say by the time of the Marquis de Sade, by the time of Wilhelm Reich, who carried his thoughts to another level, by the time of Sigmund Freud, all of these people realized that we had a powerful force for enslaving people. And that's what they started to do. Freud did it individually through psychoanalysis, where he tried to get rich Americans would give them permission to commit adultery and therefore and then extort big contributions to the psychoanalytic society. Or people like Wilhelm Reich saw the possibilities of mass situations, taking this to a mass political level. But basically, that's what we're talking about. Over the course of the 20th century, more and more refined systems of control based on the manipulation of people's desires and calling this capitulation to desire freedom.
Yeah, it's amazing how they managed to do this. We don't have an appreciation for reason and morals anymore. And at least when I look around, I do see people that are enslaved by their desires and the functions of the body. I mean, even being overweight is partially an expression of this, you know, keeping our appetites satisfied all the time, effectively being controlled by those who, you know, hold the carrot. But I don't know how much you follow modern entertainment, Michael, but this can be quite interesting to watch, to see how things change and transform as a way to kind of, well, take the temperature, if you will, out there. But it's all about how they're pushing the limits all the time, right? There always have to be something new that attracts due to its shock value.
Right.
Otherwise, it's boring, you know, it's something old farts enjoy, right? So where are the limits going to be pushed next? That is the question. And let me just go on a short rant here, because I came across something a while back about another, you know, wonderful layer to the cake of degeneracy and corruption when I was looking into Brian Williams, the ABC news anchor that was caught lying about all his, you know, major stories. Big surprise, right? Anyway, his daughter, Allison Williams, is part of a TV show called Girls by this Lena Dunham character, who, by the way, recently wrote in her biography that she had experimented sexually with her younger sister. Great role model to put on the TV. But anyway, Allison Williams did this scene in this TV show, Girls, that was consequently reviewed by Gawker and other online smut rags that saw this as a major, exciting step forward in television and also sex routines, heterosexual sex routines specifically. And, well, this is not for the faint of heart here, so hold on to your hat if you are, let's say, more traditional. You know, skip ahead a little bit, but I'll just tell you a few details from the piece that they reviewed and extended on in this article. It was called The Booty-Eating Renaissance. That was the headline. And it begins, quote, long considered a taboo in heterosexual circles, oral anal sex or anilingus, known colloquially as tossing salad, rimming, and eating booty has been a steady topic of conversation over the past few months, unquote. It goes on to say, quote, straight people seem to have finally discovered that they too have assholes that can be explored for sexual pleasure, that gay men don't have a monopoly on anuses, unquote. And this is the, quote, queering of straight sex, unquote. Anyway, I'll spare you from the stomach-turning details, but the article basically goes on to try to convince us that this is getting more and more popular, you know, thanks to TV shows like Girls and rappers like, what's his name, Chris Brown and Nicki Minaj, etc. So now it's finally reaching into the homes of Middle America and the rest of the world that is under the spell of pop culture and mass media. Finally, we can be liberated from the tyranny of the fascist prudes that for all this time weren't pushing anilingus on a daily basis on the television to the relatively young audience that the show like Girls targets. Consider yourself liberated, folks. And by the way, the comments, I wanted to see what the reaction to the story was, but they basically go on and elaborate on the cleaning procedures, instructional advice on how to not get flavor of, please forgive me, excrement on your taste buds. Yep, that's right. Well, folks, I apologize for the language and the potential imagery that this has conjured up for you, but I'll link up the story. You can read it yourself, see what you think. I just want to explain to you of what some of the dialogue is that goes on within the mainstream pop culture, you know, discussion circles, what that really is. Anyway, I just don't see how the Sodom and Gomorrah references here are clearer to, you know, at least Christians. But the question is, what is next and how far will this go? Because ultimately, I anyway personally don't care about what people do in their own homes or what kind of sex they're interested in having, you know, whatever. But when this advocacy and promotion and normalization of these kinds of things goes into children's and teenagers' heads unfiltered without parents being there educating them along the way, I think that we need to ask ourselves if these are the values that should be pushed on TV and in movies and where this is going to go next, if all this ultimately is about pushing the boundaries and breaking limits and barriers and borders. So what's next? I mean, normalizing pedophilia or bestiality? I don't know. Nothing seems to be off limits to some of these folks, Michael. But what do you think? What is next here? What's the next high?
Well, you could talk to the, you could read the Marquis de Sade for the actual trajectory. St. James in the Bible says that the wages of sin is death. When passion was aroused, the ultimate result was death. And that's what the Marquis de Sade says. They're first are the simple passions, then complex passions, then criminal passions, and finally they're murderous passions. So it's always heading toward death in some way or another. That's the objective trajectory of sexuality released from the moral order. And the outcome culturally is horror movies. This is another book I wrote. It's called Monsters from the Id. And basically, it took Frankenstein, Dracula, and Alien and tried to show that these monsters were the outcome of horror is the outcome of morality, of sexuality released from the moral law. So to give the most recent example, during the 1970s, we had particular transgression in terms of film, in terms of first-run movies, Hollywood films. Okay, as I said, the Jews broke the code in 65. 73, we have Deep Throat, which is a pornographic film that was shown in first-run theaters across the country. Deep Throat is, I'm sure you know what this is about.
Sure, yeah.
So I don't have to go into graphic detail here. But this isn't the end of the story. I think that Alien is the sequel to Deep Throat. And I don't think these people knew what they were doing. I interviewed Hans-Rudi Giger, who just died, the Swiss designer of the monster.
Oh, yeah, did he just die?
Yeah, he just died about a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I interviewed him, called him up and interviewed him, and told him, you got all these pictures of dead babies in your drawings. Where did all this come from? And he said his girlfriend had committed suicide. But the story, it's like a collaborative. This is what makes it so interesting. It's not just Hans-Rudi Giger. It's Dan O'Bannon and it's Ridley Scott. And they all get together and they come up with a parable of post-sexually liberated America, or post-sexually liberated world. And it's sort of set in outer space. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the story. But
oh, sure. I've seen it many times, yeah.
Yeah, well, most people have seen it. Anyway, so John Hurt, they land on this planet. They walk into the spaceship. Suddenly something attaches itself to John Hurt's face, and then it drops off, and everything seems to be okay. Well, what happened, what it was this monster that stuck its penis down his throat. So it's like the sequel to Deep Throat, except now it's not funny anymore.
Right.
It's horrifying. And I'm saying this is sort of what happened to sex. This is a trajectory of sex. Once it's released, it becomes horrifying. And everybody found, I think, Alien cathartic. You know, they'd go to the movie after listening to all the propaganda about sexual liberation, and they'd see that sex is dangerous. Sex will kill you. Sex is a monster. It's this monster is trying to kill you. And they all said, yeah, that's right. That's my, and I can't say it, because if I say it, people think I'm a loser. I got a venereal disease, but I can't really, but that doesn't change the fact that I'm for sexual liberation, or I had an abortion, or someone broke my heart. All this type of stuff was all embodied in that monster, and all these horror movies that followed from it, all the slasher movies, Halloween came out around the same time. This is the trajectory. And it came out, it was manifested by people who, if you ask them, they'd say, no, that's not what I believe. That's crazy. But that's what it was. I mean, you can't deny it. I think if I ever do a sex ed course, I'm going to base it on slasher movies.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before, actually, that angle to it, because I wanted to run this by you, too. I was recently rewatching again. It's a documentary called, I don't know if you've seen it, Hollywoodism, Jews, Movies, and the American Dream. It's based on a book called An Empire of Their Own, of how Jews created Hollywood.
Neil Gabler's book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is the documentary version of that. And he talked about that many of the stories. He brought up, Frankenstein, as you did, not directly, but you could see it in the same category. He brought up King Kong, for example. And he argued in there that these were stories about the outsider as an identification of Jews in Europe, let's say, or even when Jews came to America, that they saw themselves as not being part of it or included within it, which is, of course, very strange considering that they were let into America and Europe, too, for that matter, and then became very prominent, as we've seen, in a lot of positions. But the author argued that, for example, movies like Frankenstein's Monster was about conjuring up imagery of, pogroms or persecution of wicked, evil Europeans, chasing out the monster with, pitchforks and tortures and things like this. But what I thought was interesting here as well, that this was basically about the transvaluation of values, that the antagonist, it's about turning the antagonist into the protagonist of
right.
us associating with the, not only the underdog, as they put it in the documentary, but the loser and the gangster and these kinds of issues. And that's kind of how I would see Hollywood if I try to look at it objectively of how it's been used. And if we again look objectively at the founders of Hollywood and authors like Neil Gabler, writes himself, but frankly, with all these things in mind, I don't see how any of this can be viewed as controversial. I mean, the author is very proud of their accomplishment and achievements, but then when you point this out, all hell breaks loose. I mean, if you look at the minority controlling Hollywood and how much focus there is on this minority in a lot of TV shows and films like we did in our episode on Hollywoodism, I don't get why this is such a sensitive area to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, if a goy says that Hollywood created Jews, he's known as an anti-Semite. And Neil Gavler, who wrote the book How Hollywood Created the Jews, will denounce you as an anti-Semite, which he did to some Englishman who said that not too long ago.
Sure, yeah.
Here you're talking about a related issue. You're talking about the Jews and their position in society. The Jews are always outsiders. They always feel uncomfortable when there's a strong, dominant culture, especially if that culture is Christian. And so they always are going to promote the outsider as a way of destroying majority culture or Christian culture or whatever you want to call it. And so this is we have none other than Senator Joe Biden speaking to the ADL, the main Jewish organization, praising them, saying Jews are behind gay marriage. Now, if you say that or I say that, I'm an anti-Semite. But when Joe Biden says it is praise, well, then that's okay. But I think that's the point that I'm trying to make here, that they were always promoting deviance. The Jews were always promoting deviance, and they got a very powerful vehicle, basically the most powerful information vehicle in the world, which is basically the media now. And so they can promote it through Hollywood films. They can promote it through the news by causes like gay marriage. Gay marriage is, as Joe Biden pointed out, it's a totally Jewish operation, because what it's trying to do is destroy marriage. Because if you destroy marriage, then you weaken the dominant culture. And when you weaken the dominant culture, the Jews are strong. So that explains their whole psychological involvement with that. But this horror movie thing is a different thing. It's a different thing because nobody intended it. It is just a natural description of the trajectory of sexual liberation leading to death. All of these people came to it independently of each other. And then it became kind of like a fashion. By the mid-80s, there were all of these slasher films. And then Wes Craven started to do the Scream series, which was basically a satire of the tropes of the horror movie. But it doesn't change the fact that, you know, Wes, you don't understand what you're doing. Same thing to Rudy Hunts, Rudy Giger. You don't understand what you're doing. There's a power greater than you that is, in a sense, dictating what you're saying. Or as Augustine would say, even those who set themselves up against you do but copy you in a perverse way. This is exactly what horror movies was.
Yeah, it's sex and death, right? It's like a modern pop concert. They've turned into this, and usually, of course, they go kind of together, and usually even in the movies themselves, they actually have a lot of, usually they have naked women and things like this, right? It's kind of subtextually showing you this, but so you're saying that this is something which basically has just kind of come through us due to the projection, the trajectory that we are on already, that this was like
the natural trajectory that follows from sex liberated from the moral law. So every horror movie is basically the same thing. As soon as the girl takes off her clothes, some monster jumps out of the bushes and stabs her to death. It's the same story over and over and over again. Well, that's a really moral story, I think. You know, that's why I would base my sex ed course on slasher movies. Just tell the girls, as soon as you take off any article of clothing, some monster is going to stab you to death. So don't do it. Think it over.
Very predictable. Yeah, that's right. So tell us, who is, when you went to India recently, tell us about this and what you saw there, and also, of course, how you view that this could be maybe by us viewed as an example, or for us to get a little bit of a lesson of how things maybe went down in our societies. Is that how you see it, or is it very much different now? Or?
Yes, no. Basically, everything that happened in America in the 1950s and 60s, every instance of social engineering that took place over the entire post-war period is now happening in India all at once. It's just an incredible attempt at transforming one of the most ancient cultures on the face of the earth. So it's I went there because my pastor is an Indian. He grew up in Mangalore in the south of India, and we just had, you know, we knew each other, and suddenly he just realized he heard that I had been to Iran. We started talking about that, and he said, "Well, come to India with me." So I did. I went there. We arrived just before the new year, and I traveled around to meet all of his friends. He's got a huge acquaintance circle there. And basically, we went to a number of the schools that he founded. He founded five different Catholic schools in the Diocese of Jamshedpur. And this is where the analogy between America in the 50s and India really struck me. They have these huge Catholic schools. You walk out, and there are 2,000 Indian kids in Catholic school uniforms, getting ready to go to school. So I told them, I said, I grew up in Philadelphia in the 1950s and 60s, and Philadelphia had the largest Catholic high school in the world, Cardinal Doherty High School, 5,000 students, girls in purple, maroon uniforms. You could, as far as the eye could see, buses there taking these kids home after school. It had the largest Catholic grade school in the world, Most Blessed Sacrament Parish. 3,000 students, and they're destroyed. They don't even exist now. And so I told the Indians, I said, this is what's going to happen to you. This is because you are now the prime guinea pig in the world's social experiment, the laboratory of social engineering. Now that the capitalist powers have declared war on Russia, the most important thing they need to do is to divide up the powers of the Eurasian landmass, which means they cannot allow Russia and Iran, for example, to get together, and they cannot allow Russia and India to get together, or Russia and China. Of course, the geniuses at the State Department have brought about the exact opposite. Their stupid Victoria Nuland's stupid coup d'etat in the Ukraine has now brought about the exact opposite of what these people had intended. And so it's an example of what Hegel would call the cunning of history, their list of Vernunft. So what's happening now is that India is basically offering itself up like the sacrificial lamb on the altar of capitalism, basically allowing the West to come in and do whatever they want. And so I was there at the time when Obama showed up. I was there when Obama was in Delhi.
Yeah.
And you can tell what's going on. You can tell there's Narendra Modi cutting a deal with Obama. And it sounds good until the next day. Who are the people that they're getting together? Well, it's CEOs from India, CEOs from the United States. So they're going to slice and dice up India in their interest, which means the whole purpose of this Indian experiment is cheap labor. That's what the West is interested in India. They're interested in exploiting the cheap labor possibilities in India. And there's something there. There are people, you can go, once you get into the Indian economy, you get a cup of tea for 6 cents. You get a ride on a bus. I went to the beach. You get a ride to the beach in two buses. That costs 12 cents, 20 cents, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's really cheap. It's really cheap. But it's a house built on sand. It's not going to last. And secondly, the people who are the IT people, the people in Bangalore who are answering your phone when you call up for a tow truck in South Bend, Indiana, they are not going to benefit from this. Basically, the wage differential between India and America is the Indians earn 1/6 of what an American would earn. So a job at Ford Motor Company, which would pay $120,000 in the United States, it pays $20,000 in India. Okay, now $20,000, if you pay 12 cents for a bus ride and 6 cents for a cup of tea, that sounds like a lot. But until you start finding a place to live, and what you see there are these huge high-rise buildings being built all over the world. The Walter Gropius's Wohnmaschinen. If you're familiar with Berlin, think of Gropiusstadt in Berlin.
We have them in Sweden too. The socialist high rises, they're just these monstrosities. So come out of the kind of the central planning of governments, right? That's the one you're talking about? Yeah.
That's right. They were a manifestation of exactly what you're talking about, the socialist central planning that basically spread around the world in the after World War II.
Yeah.
Gropius, the Bauhaus school that he founded, split up when Hitler arrived, and Ernst Mayr went to Moscow, and Walter Gropius went to Cambridge, to Harvard, and between them they conquered the world of the 1950s. And all of these high-rise buildings were built. And so on the south side of Chicago, you put all of the sharecroppers, the black sharecroppers from Mississippi, put them in these big high-rise buildings. Well, the result was disaster. Disaster. Crime. Murder. The results in Berlin were disaster. The results in the former Soviet bloc were disaster. Alcoholism. It just is not a human place to live. So
that's right.
So now it's being promoted in India. Well, I don't see how's it going to succeed in India. Maybe you can tell me. Maybe it succeeded in Sweden. I don't know.
It's you're absolutely right. I mean, I remember this too. I actually remember beautiful city of Gothenburg. These lovely old wooden houses. There's still a few streets left that actually people go visit to see how lovely the people used to live there. But they basically took a wrecking ball to the entire town, and several people actually killed themselves because the places they did grew up in with their parents and houses they built themselves were just demolished for the sake of building these concrete monstrosities, which is like a stab in the heart for anybody who appreciates fine architecture, you know. So
right,
absolutely, it's horrendous actually to have people live. They claim, of course, that this is to heighten your racist living standards, right? That's what they said.
Sure,
but it on an emotion, and it might to a certain extent, it might in terms of you have central heating in some of these houses, water access is easier, but the way that you feel when you live in these houses, oof, I wouldn't trade that in for the opposite. You know?
No. Now you added, Gunnar Myrdal was heavily involved in social engineering.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He wrote a book on race. He didn't write the book. I discussed this in my book, The Slaughter of Cities. He could not have written that book. He was just a figurehead that was brought in to ratify the social engineering plans of the elites in America. But okay, you live in Sweden. I mean, I'm promoting Scandinavian culture here by wearing my Norwegian sweater. I went cross-country skiing today. You know, I'm feeling very Scandinavian now. It's winter, and so, okay, everybody's inside in climates like this, you know. India is not like that at all. India is the most social place I have ever met, I've ever been in the world. Because when you're on the road, you're basically driving through everyone's living room, dining room, kitchen, and bedroom. They live on the streets. They cook on the streets. So you go down the street and there's a woman washing her hair next to a guy who's fixing his motorcycle, next to a guy who's getting a haircut, next to a guy who's a woman who's cooking dinner, and so on and so forth. This is the most sociable people in the world. And I stayed with a guy in Mumbai, actually the brother of Father Cyril. He takes me through his neighborhood. Everybody's out on the street, just sitting on the street. Now, you mean to tell me these people can all be stuck in these high-rise buildings where they can't talk to each other? They're 80 stories high in Mumbai.
Yeah.
80 stories. You mean you're up on the 79th floor and you're going to be able to hang out with your friends? No. No, I can't. I think if it failed in a place like Chicago with a winter like Chicago, or Berlin with a winter like Berlin, or Warsaw or Moscow, it's doomed in a place like India where the people are used to hanging out on the street with each other. It can't succeed. So I think that what's going to happen, this is kind of vindicated what I said when I did that article on the rape crisis in India, which appeared in the November issue. This is before I went to India, but I did enough research, I think, because I think I understand. We've already talked about this trajectory. You sexualize the culture, you're going to create a monster. And the monster here in India is rape. It's rape. Now, nobody, I think I can say with complete assurance, no social engineer ever intended that rape would spread like an epidemic through Indian culture. That was not the intention of anyone. but it is the logical outcome of the sexualization of a traditional culture. It's the logical outcome. It's a sort of an inchoate protest by the people who feel that something's happening and they don't understand it.
Right.
That's what's happening now in India. So you get these, so you have this huge now dislocation on the land, a 19-year-old guy who grew up in a village where they have traditional ethnic clothing in India. It's called the sari. The sari is modest dress for women. Whether we consider it modest or not, the Indians all consider it modest. That's what they're used to.
Mm.
So this guy who can't find a job in the village now goes to Mumbai or Calcutta, and he's hired as a day laborer, and he gets a cell phone, and now he can download pornographic images on his cell phone, and he's totally deranged. This has a deranging effect on him, and the result is he gets drunk, and then he rapes somebody. That's what's going on right now. It's right out of the horror movie playbook of the 1970s, and now it's happening in India. And so as a result now, you've got a guy like Modi who is trying to mobilize this force politically. So instead of saying, look, it's capitalism. Capitalism is destroying our culture. Capitalism is corrupting our morals so that they can exploit our cheap labor. Modi is working with the RSS, this basically Hindu fundamentalist organization that is now blaming Christianity for the decline of India.
Oh, really?
It's like right out of St. Augustine and the fall of Rome. You know, like you have this traditionalist culture. They say, well, things were better before Christianity came. Things got worse. So therefore, Christianity caused it. And so therefore, we need to destroy Christianity. That's the same thing that's happening in India right now. And Modi was dishonestly, I have to say, trying to promote it. He's using the Christians as a scapegoat. He's not condemning it. And then, the Hindus who don't understand what's going on find a scapegoat. And so as a result, you have forced conversions of Christians. 4,000 Indians are forced to convert back to Hinduism because the default setting of Indian culture is Hinduism. Period. No notion that, well, you know, that first of all, the St. Francis Xavier showed up here 500 years ago. These people didn't become Christians yesterday. It's been a half a millennium so far. But second, you know, there are lots of issues here, you know, and they're going to have to come to grips with them sooner or later. That's the issue in India in a nutshell right now.
Interesting. Globalism, another side effect here, of course. We're going to take a break in a little bit here, but I want to squeeze in one more question before we do that. And it had to do with, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about if there's any indication here of who's pulling the strings here, because you mentioned, of course, people from the political sphere that they're kind of willfully, dealing with the CEOs of other, transnational corporations, etc. But someone has opened the door in some capacity. This didn't happen by itself. Is there any way that we can figure out what and who lies behind this?
Well, you'll have to be specific. You know, you have to say at a specific time who was involved and who was doing it.
Right.
And what were they involved in? So if you want to go back to America in the 1920s, the WASP ruling class became very upset. They started using birth control. And when they started using birth control, they became very aware of people who were not using birth control, which were namely two groups, blacks and Catholics. And so they created an institution called Planned Parenthood, which was basically there to force or seduce or whatever you want to coerce these undesirable races to use birth control and limit their family. So at this point, you had demographic warfare going on, and it reached its a peak with the Rockefeller Population Council after World War II. And the whole spread they captured the United States government. Okay, Lyndon Johnson in 1965 in a State of the Union address mentions population, overpopulation, because John D. Rockefeller told them to mention it. It's not great minds running in the same circles. He met one of them and said, "This, you got to talk about this," and Johnson would go along with anybody who was rich or powerful. And so he did. And so as a result, you had basically the United States projecting demographic warfare onto the rest of the world. A place like India, for example. Indira Gandhi ran out of money. When she went to the IMF, they said you have to population control. And so Sanjay Gandhi was in charge of it, and it caused huge uproar, social uproar. These workers going around giving the ignorant, illiterate Dalits, the untouchables, a transistor radio if they would allow themselves to have a vasectomy. The outcry was so bad that Sanjay was murdered as a result of it. But there was a big reaction, and basically all of population control became a taboo. Even the population controllers weren't talking about it anymore.
Right.
So
yeah.
you have to be specific about what we're talking about. At this time, let's say in the 70s, just as the Rockefellers are going down, the Jews are coming up. The Jews were, through think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, through the whole neoconservative movement, they basically stole a march on the kind of exhausted liberalism of the Rockefellers, the Trilateral Commission. And they introduced a new virulent strain of American imperialism that we're still suffering from. We're talking about the George H.W. Bush becoming involved. He becomes the head of the CIA. Jimmy Carter becomes president, fires Bush, fires 2,000 CIA rogue agents. They coalesce around George Bush. George Bush then orchestrates the whole hostage crisis, extends it for 444 days to get Ronald Reagan elected. And now we have a new strain of capitalism that's in many ways much more virulent and worse than the Protestant strain. You know?
Yeah,
and
oh, sure. Yeah.
And that's what we're dealing with today. You know the story, the invasion of Iraq, 9/11, whoever was behind that. But basically it all got started with this desire to have these proxy Mujahideen warriors in Afghanistan fighting the Soviets. You know, a guerrilla warfare, a proxy war where the United States, the CIA, was pouring billions of dollars in weapons, putting them in the hands of the Mujahideen, who then became a Frankenstein. They took on a life of their own, symbolized best by Osama bin Laden or by ISIS right now.
That's right. You know? Yep.
You know, so I'm just trying to say, if you want to talk about the details of who did what and to whom, you just have to be specific about time and place. So.
Absolutely. No, I get you. I wanted to talk a little bit more about actually India specifically, but it's always interesting hearing about the backdrop in America. So I didn't want to cut you off there, but we can pick that up in the second here, Michael, and continue to talk more about what goes on there. I actually saw a video of yours recently too that was really good. I don't know if you titled it this, but it was called The Goy Guide to World History. Someone uploaded it to YouTube, and there was some very interesting things on the historical basis here that I might want to ask you a little bit more about in the second segment. But before we do that, let's talk about your books and your website. Of course, we primarily here in the first segment talk about Libido Dominandi, which is one that came out in 2005, I believe. But give us some of your other book titles and tell us more about your website, and also, of course, how people can sign up for the Culture Wars. Is it a newsletter, magazine? What would you call it?
It's a monthly magazine. Yeah. It's a monthly magazine. In a sense, Culture Wars, I founded this 35 years ago. And it's the basis pretty much of everything I do. An idea will germinate in Culture Wars, and then eventually it may end up as a book, one way or the other. So to the most recent book is Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as the Conflict Between Labor and Usury. That tried to address the economic collapse of 2008. That is also the sequel, in a sense, to The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, which is another big book that I wrote in, that came out in 2000, I forget now when these books came out, 2008 or 9, something like that. And that book was basically about the Jewish takeover of American foreign policy under the neocon era, the George Bush era. And how could that have happened? You know, those two are big, long histories of basically the West. You know, before that, the book on horror, Monsters from the Id, the book on social engineering, Slaughter of Cities, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. That book came out about 20 years ago and was in many ways my take on the Clinton presidency.
Oh, yeah, you know, that's like right. Yeah, I remember
Monica
that.
Lewinsky, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Here's a man, if there were ever a man who was controlled by his illicit passions, it's Bill Clinton, you know? And that book has now gotten legs. in certain places. The Polish bishops just issued a pastoral letter on what they call gender ideology that is pretty much based on libido dominandi. That book now has come out in Polish. I did a book tour in Poland about 2 years ago. It's an idea whose time has come. All you have to do is say sexual liberation is a form of political control, and everybody immediately says, yeah, I understand that. You know, yeah. Here's the book, and to explain the whole thing in detail. It is now, I've given talks in Iran now. Iran is a really unique situation where they rebelled against Western American imperialism in a radical way in 1979. And have been subjected to all sorts of covert black ops trying to destroy their revolution. And one of the main vehicles has been sexual liberation. When I was in Iran, I met women who told me that they go out in the morning, you know, to get the milk and the newspaper, and there's a DVD on their doorstep, and they put it in the computer, and it's pornography. A classic instance of the weapon of pornography trying to subvert the revolution in Iran. So I've spoken there, and, you know, I'll probably go back and talk more about it. You know, so, I mean, basically you're talking about a guy who woke up at one point in his life and realized he had been a guinea pig. My generation, the baby boomer generation in America, they had been guinea pigs in an experiment that nobody was willing to talk about.
That's right. It's amazing, isn't it, when you think about it, the consequences that it's had and how quickly everything has changed, not only in America, but in Europe, too. And no one is really talking about it. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about a new form of warfare. And you're talking about a population that thinks, well, warfare, well, that means the guys in the blue uniforms, they fire cannons at the guys in the red uniforms. No, that's not what warfare is now. On the beginning in 1953, we had what they called psychological warfare, and that's what it's been ever since. And in a sense, the population is still trying to catch up to the latest advances of warfare, how these people will come in and destroy your culture. The whole, the East, Eastern Europe, the former communist countries, are now finally waking up to the fact that the capitalists are not your friends.
Yeah.
Just because they hated communism doesn't mean they're your friend. And you were taken to the cleaners. And now I think Poland is a classic example of a country that's waking up and realizing, wait a minute, we got to do something here. This is not what they told us when we signed on. We got to do something.
Very good. We'll pick this up and talk more here in the second segment. We'll take a short break here, folks. But in the meantime, then check out culturewars.com. And also, of course, right there at the top, you do have the links to the monthly magazines there if you want to pick up copies of that. Very interesting. I have two copies here that Michael wrote in terms of the situation in India. We'll see if we can return a little bit more to that as well. But, yeah, stay with us, everybody. Stay with us. E. Michael Jones. We'll be right back with more. The second hour with E. Michael Jones is coming right up at redicemembers.com, our members' website. You can go there to sign up and tune in to this or any of our previous shows. We have almost 1,000 programs on a lot of different topics. Well, Michael shares with us the difficult question of censorship, as we have an attitude today that anything goes. At least in the West, our open democratic countries, anything goes, except the banned, the silenced, and the censored, of course. But let's not get stuck in the details here. However, as you put things into perspective, when people today have a license to exploit people's passions, how do we deal with this in the best way? Can and should we always just choose for ourselves? Or is there more sinister techniques of manipulation here that can be harmful to us? Just in the same way that other invisible forces that we're not aware of, radiation, Wi-Fi, microwaves, etc., are dangerous to us as well. So do we need restrictions on any of this? Jones also tells us more about Freudian Marxism, the sexual psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich, a very popular figure in the alternative that many don't know, have inserted a lot of the Frankfurt School ideas, the subversive ideas, into the alternative as well. They kind of came along with a package, if you ask me. We speak about the sexualization of the Catholic clergy. We speak about Protestant and Catholic division. Also about the breakdown of civilization when we leave Logos. And he also shares with us a little bit about his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. It is a very interesting and thought-provoking conversation here coming up, ladies and gentlemen, as we proceed with E. Michael Jones for a second hour at redicemembers.com. Before we proceed, on Wednesday you can hear a Radio 314 with Carl Rodell. We also have on Red Ice Radio Dean Clifford, who is out from prison. We're going to speak about his experiences and why he was imprisoned for 16 months. We also have Marianne Van Court, Daniel Spalding, Joseph Atville, Dr. Joseph Mercola, Mike Cross, and many more. All right, folks, that wraps it up for the first hour here, but we're ready to get started with the second. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you on the other side of the break.